I am going to endeavor this morning to at least bring you up till the turn of the century, the 1900 era, and give you an idea of the tremendous changes that took place in this nation. Really, probably the greatest time of expansion or blessing that this nation has ever known. The drastic changes that took place and fueled largely by the settlement of the Civil War and the ideals that brought about the Civil War being behind us, and time to move on and time to rebuild and put things back together. But more than that, a spiritual element involved, and I think God beginning to bless spiritually the nation, and we'll look at some of that this morning, and the technological advances. Of course, when we say technology, we think about computers and things like that. Technology to these people were the ability to get into their fields and reap their crops and that type of thing, but nonetheless, technology and great technological advances. Now, I didn't mark last week where I finished, so I'm going to just start, and if I've covered a lot of this, then you can flag me down. We'll move on ahead, but it wouldn't hurt to review some of these things this morning anyway. The six reasons, basically, for the prosperity in America following the Civil War and that era there, and I mentioned them for you. I know these were mentioned last week, but we'll just hit on them briefly. First of all, the new inventions and discoveries. And we'll look at some of those in a few minutes. The abundance of natural resources in this nation as yet was virtually untapped. The great storehouse of resources that we had was virtually untapped, and we had water and coal and wood and all of those precious materials, not to mention gas and oil that came out of the ground a little later. All of those things in abundance here that helped push this growth that we saw in our nation. Also a large labor supply. A lot of people that were immigrating to this country just not looking for a handout, not looking for welfare, but looking for a chance. And receiving it in this country, but also providing a large workforce from which could be drawn the people needed to work in industry and such as that. Also, surplus capital. There was money available. And while the Civil War had decimated the South, it had also produced some money for some people who invested wisely along those lines, particularly in the North. There was some money available. Also, some of the immigrants that were coming to America at that time were not just the poor. We talk about the poor huddled masses that were coming to America, but there also were at that time people coming that had great amount of money. And they were bringing their money with them, and that money was to be invested, and most of them did so, and that capital that we had helped produce the growth that we saw in our country. Also, cheap transportation. We talked about the increase of the railways and how the mileage of railway more than tripled, I believe, if I can remember the figures exactly, in just a few years' time, and gave rise to the fact that you not only, prior to that, you had to build your factories on the coast. Because you wanted an area where you could, first of all, import materials that you might not have and needed, and you'd have to import them from across the sea. So you needed your factory close to the place where you could pick those materials up. Also, you wanted to be close to the sea so you could export the goods that you produced. And so the seaboard of the nation was growing very rapidly. And unless there was a waterway connecting that city with the seaboard, there was not much going to be done. You had some areas that sprang up. Of course, Cleveland and places like that would not be hampered because they were near waterways, and with the Erie Canal and things like that, they had access to other areas. You had Cincinnati, you had New Orleans, and places like that where you have a location to waterways from which you could export and import, which was so very important. With the advent of railways, you were connecting the coastline or the waterways with far distant places that had no access before. And so places could spring up where goods could be produced and taken on then to the areas that were necessary by rail. And cheap transportation became one of the means of boosting the growth in America. And then the stimulant of the Civil War, and we talked about that. how people had grown tired of war. It doesn't take long to grow tired of war. This war had raged for 5 years, 4 or 5 years in this nation, and people were tired of it. It was not a war like most of us have known, which is a long way across the sea at best, and we see pictures of it on television, and unless we're called to go and fight, we very rarely are touched by that war. But this was a war where every American had been touched and had seen the fruits of war, and had seen some of the terror that comes along with war. Even if you lived in the North, a lot of those young men coming home were maimed and injured that were never again to be the same as they went away. The North lost by far and away more men in the Civil War than the South did. They had more men, obviously, to start out with, and they lost a tremendous amount of soldiers in that conflict. And there were a lot of widows, and there were a lot of orphans created by that war, and America had just grown tired. And they'd grown tired of seeing the ravages of war, and they were ready to get on and move on. And so that sparked or stimulated the growth that this nation saw in the end of the Civil War until the turn of the century. And a couple other things that we mentioned were people of character. People that had something about them. They were not get something for nothing type crowd. It seems like that's what we deal with today, how I can get more for less and how I can get away with more. Seems to be the age of no character that we live in now. And that was not the way that it was. Now, there's always been bad people. Okay, I don't want to give you this idea that everybody was an angel back here. It's always been bad people. But even bad people believed in what was called the Protestant work ethic. And it was called the Protestant work ethic until about 30 years ago, and then it became known as just the American work ethic for fear that somebody would be offended if we called it what we'd always called it. And if you want to know why it was called the Protestant work ethic, you can look at areas where Roman Catholicism has dominion, control or sway, and you'll see there's not much of a work ethic in any of those countries. And people that had the desire to work and came here were willing to work hard and long hours to produce what they could. They fared real well, but there were some people of character in this nation that took this nation to really an all-time high by the turn of the century. Also, economic freedom. And I think this is probably where we closed out last week. We were talking about laissez-faire capitalism, and this is not an economics course, nor is it really a history course by and large. It's supposed to be a spiritual matter, but we've kind of delved into every area that we could think of. Laissez-faire capitalism is to be desired. It is not what we have in America today. America is probably about 85% socialist right now. And we talk about, boy, what would change if the Russians took over? Not a lot, really. Your wages would probably be cut in about a fifth of what they are now, and everything that you own would belong to the government, but it already does. And if you don't believe that, you try not paying taxes on your private property and see whether you own it or not. You live in a socialistic society, and you know, the people that run the railways or the radio waves, I guess, probably better, more accurate, and talk about the problems in America, and you know, the problem is with the rich, and the problem is with this and that and the other thing. The problem is with governing capitalism. Okay, honest to goodness, capitalism cannot be governed if it is to be successful. And that's a problem to people who are in government, because they want to govern. They want to run. They want to regulate. They want to control. And that's the whole idea behind government. When we talk about downsizing government, people think, well, you immediately want to starve the poor. No, listen, the whole idea is the least amount of government is necessary is what's to be desired. And that idea of government and control gets into some people, and they want to control virtually every area of your life. To me, I think the government has no business with determining how many trees are to be cut down in America every year. You know, what in the world has that got to do with governing a country? And you know, we've got government control in virtually every industry that there is, and America has suffered. And now you've got people polarized, and the Democrats pointing the finger at the Republicans, and the Republicans pointing a finger at the Democrats. And to be honest with you, neither one of their philosophies are the problem. To be honest with you, I mean, I'll be honest with you this morning, I'm neither one. I've never voted in an election. I've never registered on either side of the political process. You say, why? I think everybody ought to vote, except me. You say, why aren't you registered? So when I get up and preach, you can't accuse me of being partisan. I realized that years ago, and that's the exact reason I gave up my right to vote. It was not a thing I just didn't want to do this or that or the other thing. Years ago, I got out of Bible college when I was 20 years of age, and I sat down and analyzed the process, and first time I preached two or three sermons, people said, well, you know, you preach awful hard on some people, and I said, well, I don't want people to get the wrong idea. I'm not partisan. But I'll be honest with you, I think the Democrats have got some ideas. I think that, listen, you don't just let people starve to death in your country. I agree with that. Something has to be done to take care of people that can't take care of themselves. I'm not opposed to that. I think you need to take care of your senior citizens. I think there are things along that line. They've got some ideas on. I don't agree with how they're going about doing it. By the same time, I think the Republicans have got some ideas. The worst sin of a nation is to condemn its wealthy people. That's a tragedy. The worst sin of a nation is to condemn its wealthy people. And when you condemn wealth, you're not going to stop producing it. And when you stop producing it, you talk about trickle-down economics, try trickle-down starvation. And if you don't believe that, look at when some of these corporations close up like they have in Toledo over the last few years. Look at what happened at LOF, what happened at DeVilbiss, what happened at Champion, some of these other companies that said, hey, forget it, we're out of here. And you say, what happened? I'll tell you the reason they left. They weren't making the money they wanted to make. Now, you can talk about it being greed, you can talk about it being, you know, these people are just insensible, and I mean, after all, they're just in it for the money. Well, that's exactly why Champion pulled out of this town. That's exactly why DeVilbiss closed its doors, because the people who owned and operated those companies were not making the money they wanted. And you say, well, that's an atrocity, that's terrible. Well, the answer to that is let them make the money they want to make. You say, well, that just is unfair. No, listen, there were a bunch of people doing all right because those companies were in town. They were making money while the company made money. You know what? There's nobody in town making any money from DeVilbiss today. And I still think of four or five people that are laid off from LOF, been laid off for 12, 13 years. Why? Well, when the rich guy's not getting his, nobody else is going to get theirs either. Now, you know, that's almost taboo to speak that way, and again, I'm not teaching political principles this morning, I'm just teaching you some good common sense. Laissez-faire capitalism. Leave it alone. Don't govern it, don't control it, don't regulate it, don't do anything with it. Let it control itself. Because the stop gap in laissez-faire capitalism, the controlling mechanism in laissez-faire capitalism is competition. And there needs to be competition. And when you start controlling, I'll be honest with you, it's not just the government. Your labor unions try to control capitalism. Everybody ought to get the same wage. That's garbage. The hardest workers ought to get the best wage. You can't fire anybody unless you bring it to a board of review to determine anybody that doesn't work shouldn't eat. That's biblical. You fire them. You get rid of them. We're under all kind of mandates and all kind of controls that have destroyed a capitalistic endeavor. Now, we talk about businesses. You want to create competition and low prices, you let businesses alone. We talked last week about the gas war, 1972, I think. Boy, that's a ways ago. 1972, when I first went off to Bible college, and gasoline was selling for $26.09. When I got off the interstate, if I had driven two more blocks, I could have got it for $24.09. There's a gas war. Why? Competition. 1973 or 74, the government stepped in and said, we're going to control, we're going to regulate the gasoline industry. You're not allowed to charge more than 99 cents a gallon for your gasoline, and everybody went to 99 cents a gallon. You say, what happened? You try to control it. You set caps, and everybody knows that's the cap. That's what they're going to make. That's where they take it. Capitalism promotes itself by being competitive, no regulation. If I go out here and dig the first oil well that's ever been dug, nobody's ever seen this black crude oil, and I go out and I dig it in my backyard, and I spend whatever it costs to put up the drilling rig and get it done, now I'm the only person in America bringing oil out of the ground. How much should I be able to get for my oil? Whatever I want. If I want to charge $2 million a barrel, that's my right. Nobody has the right to say, well, you can't be fair. That's just not fair. Hey, it's my oil. I'll sell it for what I want to sell it for. You said, but poor people couldn't afford it then. Oh, but wait a minute. Capitalism takes care of itself. Let me ask you a question. If Brother Philo lives next door to me, and he sees my oil rig going up, and then he sees my little stand out in front of my house there with oil barrels, and it says $2 million a barrel, what do you suppose he's going to do next year? You better believe it. Why? Because he's greedy. You see, that's the basic root of capitalism, is greed. Everybody else says, well, we shouldn't be so greedy. Yeah, but we are. So why not build an economic system that works with that? It works a whole lot better in socialism, because socialism assumes we're all benevolent. And we aren't. We're benevolent with our excess. But do you ever notice how rarely we get excess? As life goes on, it takes more and more just to promote the basic parts of life. And socialism, it precludes benevolence. And we're not benevolent. Why not work on the greed principle? Here I am. I'm his next door neighbor. I've got oil out there for $2 million a barrel. And he's going to go out and he's going to dig. And guess what? He finds oil. And he builds him a little stand. I see him and Miss Philo out there building a little stand, you know, hanging little ribbons from it and all that. And now you know what he's going to do? He's going to sell his oil for $1.5 million a barrel. Why? That's plenty of money. But all at once, all the people have been stopping at my little store. What are they going to do? They're going to go next door to his little store. Now what have we created? We've created a competitive market. And people are still going in there digging oil wells all over the city, all over the county, all over the state. Now there are oil wells. There are people, little mom-and-pop operations selling oil. Before long, you're going to see the cost of that oil come right back down there so everybody can afford it. Oh, not only that, you're going to find the oil or the steel business is going to go up profit because somebody's got to build the towers. You're going to find the drilling industry or the mining industry is going to profit because somebody's got to dig the wells. You're going to find the people that make the barrels are going to prosper because somebody's got to make the barrels. You're going to find, listen, people that use oil, you're going to find all kind of people inventing goods to use the oil. That all industry prospers when you just take your hands off of it and let it go. And you say, well, what happens, you know, when somebody gets out of control? The market always takes care of that. Anybody that's making a better mousetrap and making more money opens up a market to competition. And so laissez-faire capitalism is what we don't have in America. That's why your prices are going higher and higher and higher and higher. And you say, well, it takes more money to live. It really doesn't. It really doesn't. What has happened in America is inflation. Okay? And inflation, listen, inflation is not the increase in value of goods. A toothbrush is still worth what a toothbrush was worth 20 years ago. Why does it cost so much? It is because of the devaluation of your own money. And that's produced by control of the market. And when you try to control market, your money becomes worth less because everybody jacks their price up to the ceiling and gets it where they want to have it. We've seen it go round and round. A lot of you fellows are union employees, and sometimes we go at odds, and I don't mean to go at odds, but I just think they stink. And I've worked in a union shop before and done much better in a non-union shop. So I understand, and again, I realize there was a time when they were necessary. I just don't have to believe it's now. But you've seen trade unions, and we've all been involved, you know, in going out on strike and that type of stuff. And the union says, we're going to get another buck and a half an hour for you. And we think, boy, that's great. That's going to give me another $60 a week to take home in my pay. And isn't that wonderful? And as soon as you get that $60 a week raise, the guy where you buy your gas is going to jack up his price. And the guy that sells you groceries is going to jack up. Why? He wants a piece of that $60. And so what's happened is a boost in the cost of living. Brought about by why? You got more money to get. I mentioned to you the fact that when Henry Ford came out with his automobile back in 1909 and through there and up to about 1930, you could buy a brand new automobile, deluxe equipped. Of course, back then that was four wheels and a stick shift. Deluxe equipped, you could buy one for $1,200, brand new. 1930. $1,200. Do you know what? You could go down here and buy a Cadillac Aliante today for $1,200 in gold. You know why? Because the car's not worth anymore. Your money's just worth less. $1,200 in gold coin will buy you a Cadillac Alliante today. You can drive it home, park it in your driveway. So has the cost of living really gone up? No, the worth of your money has gone down. Your spending power is at an all-time low. So your union says, well, we want more money. So you get more money, and everyone wants the prices all go up. So have you got any more money? I'd be interested to see what the income is of the average Jeep or whatever worker out here compared to spending power. Probably find out that with all this great hoopla and all this talk of we're going to help you out, we're going to get you higher wages, that in essence you're probably making reality probably about $2 a day of what they were making in the turn of the century in buying power. Buying power. Now, a laissez-faire capitalism was what was in existence near the turn of the century. Things were happening so fast, it's always amazing the government's kind of behind, you know, in grabbing control of things. And people were making their fortune. And that's the problem, see, is whenever you create a control, your millionaires just leave it. How did millionaires get to be millionaires? Well, two ways, okay? Number one, they either inherited it, like congressmen do, or else they got out and worked for it and produced it. And if they got out and worked for it and produced it, they want to make some more. Everybody's greedy. Have you ever noticed that? We always want more. How many of you have enough money this morning? Anybody have too much? Isn't that amazing? Nobody has too much money? Nobody has enough? Why? We're greedy. If somebody walked up to you and today and gave you $1,000, tonight you'd want more. You're not fooling me. You can't satisfy the flesh. It is a greedy thing to have to deal with. And you take a millionaire, his job is to make money, and he wants to make money. When he's got some, he wants to make more. You take guys like G. Campbell Morgan and John Jacob Astor, and not G. Campbell, but Morgan and Astor, some of these guys that had all the money, the Rockefellers, they haven't just lived off the Riviera and enjoyed they keep making more money. Why? They haven't got enough. You know, you'd think if you had a couple $1 billion, you wouldn't need any more. You listen to, who's the little short guy that ran for president? What a con. You know, I just want to help America. I've made enough money. Well, so he doesn't get elected, and what does he do? He buys up all the land around the airport so that when NAFTA goes into effect, you know where most of that stuff is being shipped into Mexico from? It's being shipped into Mexico from Perot's ownings down there at the airport. Well, the guy said he was opposed to it. What's he doing making millions of dollars off of it? I'll tell you why. He's a millionaire, and he's in business to make money. Now, I'm not faulting him for that. I'm just faulting him for being a liar. I don't have any problem with him making money. More power to you. You can buy it up, make all kind of money, sell it for whatever you want to sell it for. If you can buy land at $2 an acre and turn around and sell it for $22,000 an acre, go for it. People talk about how stupid the government is for, buying $100 hammers. You never hear anybody talk about somebody selling a $100 hammer, do you? Amen? Do you know what? If I had a toilet seat I could sell for $600, I'd sell the government all they wanted for $600 a piece. You don't hear anybody getting upset about that. Why? Because we recognize the greed that's in us all. And, if you're going to sell something, you want to know what top dollar you can get for it, isn't it? Amen? Somebody said, I'm going to put something in a trading post. How much should I list it for? List it for whatever you can get for it. Matter of fact, list it for every dime you can get for it. When we get ready to list something in a trading post, do we list it high or low? We list it high. Why? Because we hate to think we listed it low and didn't get enough money for it. And so when you call somebody and you're fixing to buy something out of the trading post, what do? Do you offer him higher or lower than what he's asking? Lower, because you know he's asking more than he has to have for it. He wants to make some money. What is that? That's the economy. That's the way things work. But you get outside the realm of you and I dealing in the trading post, and you've got government regulations and sanctions and controls where a guy can't do that. Can't do that. My family's all American. We were American pre-Revolutionary War on both sides. But my father, he has never paid list price for an automobile. Never. You pay list price for an automobile, you're a fool. You say, well, the sticker said $12,000. Big deal. You know what that means? Nothing. Matter of fact, my father, after he retired, had two or three automobile agencies coming, asking him to come and work for them. Because he just deals that way. And it's called high ball and low ball. You high ball, I'll low ball. And we'll arrive at a fair price somewhere. That's competitive dealing. That's the way things ought to be done. I mean, when I go in here and ring up my grocery tab, it bugs me that they say that'll be $27.95, and I got to pay them $27.95. Why can't I say, I'll give you $25 cash? Amen. You know why you can't do that? Because government control of the food industry, and the canning industry, and the marketing industry, and the trucking industry. I mean, when I pull into a gas station, they got up there on their sign, you know, I start saying 95.9. That was when Clinton went in office. And it was. It was 95.9 for all three grades right here, the day of the swearing in of Clinton. Now it's $1.32 or whatever it is. That's prosperity. Why can't I pull in there and say, look, I'll give you $10 for a tank full. Or I'll give you $10 in this new hammer I just built. It's called a barter system. The government is now trying to gain control of bartering systems. There are bartering agencies all over the United States where you don't deal in money anymore. I know a fellow that owns a great big deal like that. He don't pay money for shoes. He goes in and buys a pair of shoes off the rack, and when he does, he writes this little check, and it's not good for money, it's good for barter. And he writes this guy a $20 check for barter, and this guy takes his $20 barter check and goes down to another barter agency where they sell shoelaces, and he buys $20 worth of shoelaces from them on barter. No money changes hands anywhere. Now, the government doesn't like that because no taxes. See, so now the government's gaining control of barter. And what in the world are you talking about here, preacher? I'm talking about how America prospered and why it's not prospering now. It's not prospering now. You can't have a system that's free for everybody or fair for everybody. We want something that's fair. And we want this guy here that only makes $1 an hour. We want him to be able to drive a Cadillac just like you can drive a Cadillac. We want a fair system. There is no system that's fair. And if you think America's got problems, you try looking at a socialistic system when it's all said and done and see how fair that is. When it was all said and done, and capitalism says, well, you lose a finger, and some people have to lose two, so we went to socialism, and they just came in and cut everybody's fingers off, and we didn't have to worry about it anymore. That's the way socialism works. You take a system where a guy comes in and invests his life, he takes his last $20,000. You say, well, it's not fair, he's got $20,000. That's beside the point. The point is, he takes all that he has got and puts it on the line to produce a product. Who's at risk? Not the consumer. Who's at risk? Not the poor person. Who can lose everything they've got? The fellow that put everything he... Now, shouldn't he have a right to get something back out of it? Who put up all the risk? The guy that invested, he put up 100% of the risk. How much of the risk did the poor person share in? None. Then what is fair about requiring him to share his profit with somebody that didn't put out any risk? You put in 100% of the risk, you ought to gain 100% of the profit. And that's what was going on in this country from 1860 till 1900, the greatest growth boom that our nation ever saw. In that area, people were inclined to invent. I've got a list here. This is just almost unbelievable. The things that were invented, I don't know how many are on here. I know there are probably 70, and these are the most impressive things that were invented from just the days prior to the Civil War till the turn of the century, on up to about 1909, 1910. But you can start 1846, which is the earliest one on here, with the sewing machine. Elias Howe invented the sewing machine. Now, let me tell you something. You know why he invented the sewing machine? Because he wanted to help out his fellow man. Right? He said, boy, I'm going to do something with my life that's going to count for my fellow. You know why he did it? He wanted to make some money. Now, let me ask you a question. Aren't you glad Elias Howe wanted to make some money? Are you glad Elias Howe was greedy? You say, well, not me, I don't sew. You're wearing clothes that were sewn on a machine he helped produce. In 1849, this is an unbelievable one. A fellow by the name of Walter Hunt. You don't even know what he invented. I told you last week, but you probably forgot. He invented a safety pin. Brother Falk will never forget. You know why he invented a safety pin? He wanted to make some money. Now, let me qualify this. Elias Howe, these guys, they may have invented it to take care of a problem in the home. That's where most inventions come from, is to meet a personal need. And Elias Howe, I don't know, he may have got up and his kids, you know, the pants were falling down. I don't know. As they go off to school, here goes his kids, and by the time they get to the front porch, you know, their pants would drop, and they, you know, they had a problem. So he invented a safety pin to hold that up. Maybe that's the reason he invented it, but I'm going to tell you how it got to be mass-produced. It got to be mass-produced because somebody saw an opportunity to make a dollar out of it. And you've got a safety pin. 1852, Elisha Otis invented the elevator. So you can go up 20 floors and come down 20 floors. Now, think about it for a minute. Here's a guy wanting to make some money. And I'm sure when Otis invented his elevator, he probably was just looking for a way to go up maybe one or two flights of stairs. Otis probably never realized that someday they would take his design and put it in buildings to take you up several hundred or at least 100 stories. He never fathomed that. But where would the skyscraper be without Otis trying to make some money? You see, these people that produced and designed to make some money, and he did. Oh, he made some money. Filthy rich fella. Wasn't it terrible? Well, you'd never had a skyscraper hadn't been for somebody like that. There are not only benefits in people producing, but there are side benefits that are produced from what these people produce. Leave a system alone. 1851, Gail Borden invented a process to condense milk and put it in cans so it didn't spoil, so you could ship it all over the country. And who in the world likes to drink condensed milk? But there was a day. There was a day when there was a market for it. In 1854, some of my heroes, a fellow by the name of Horace Smith and Daniel Wesson, invented a firearm magazine, which gave rise to the assault weapons that now are killing millions of people around the world. It's a good thing they didn't name it after their first name. I'd hate to be carrying a Horace and Daniel this morning. 1858, Hamilton Smith invented a washing machine. And my grandmother, I think, still owns one of those original ones that, you know, the old wringer on there and the whole deal. Get out in the backyard and do your laundry and all that kind of stuff. But they invented a washing machine. Now think for a minute. Are you glad this guy wanted to make some money? That's why he produced what he produced. You live in a society that's convincing you that educated people go off to school because they want to better mankind. And that's garbage. The Center for Disease Control, it exists. Why? To help mankind. No, it exists because people go there and work, make mega bucks. That's why it exists. They're trying to make a living. Now, you say, why is that important? Because after a while, you get convinced that the guys that set and govern you are looking after your best interest. Those guys are trying to make a living, trying to make a buck. Now, I'm not implicating anybody in wrongdoing. I'm just saying if you believe those guys are up there totally for humanitarian purposes, you got another thought coming. Why in the world would a guy spend $6 million to get elected to an office that pays $60,000 a year? Because there's some power that can help produce some capital. And you say, well, you shouldn't think that way. Yeah, you should. Yeah, you should. In 1858, John L. Mason invented the Mason jar. And it's still produced today with his name right on the side of it. Do you know what? Every time you go and buy some Mason jars, somebody benefits from that. And probably somebody in his family still owns some rights to that. In 1860, a fellow by the name of Oliver Winchester invented a repeating rifle. 1864, George M. Pullman invented a railroad sleeping car. In 1865, William Shepard invented liquid soap. That don't sound like much, but if you'd been using lime soap up to then, you'd have shouted hallelujah. Because all at once, you know, you didn't have to lose skin when you took a bath. In 1865, Linus Yale, Jr. invented a cylinder lock. 1866, Excelsior Needle Company made, for the first time, a machine-made needle. That was 1866. You realize that's just a little over 100 years ago when they started mass-producing the needle. And, you know, in the last 100, 110 years, there have been unbelievable changes in our society, largely because of what these people were willing to do. 1867, D.R. Averill invented ready-mix paint. When I was a student in high school, I had a guidance counselor, and I can't even think of his name now, but I remember he's a short little fellow, a little scrawny-looking guy. At least he did. I guess everybody that was a teacher looked that way when I was in high school. If they didn't, you made them look that way. But this fellow invented the latex process. The latex process is a process that causes things to exist in a congealed form and to liquefy when pressure is applied. That's what latex paint was all about. That's why it didn't run down your arm and down your brush while you were painting. It was a little more solid and it would spread easier. This guy invented that process. He was a chemist. A wealthy man. And he just came back to be a guidance counselor for whatever reason. I sure couldn't imagine myself. Maybe he did something wrong in high school and was trying to atone for his sin. But that process was invented to help make it easier for painters. Anybody else know where that process went to? That process went on into the aviation industry. And that same process was used to take jet fuel and aviation fuel and make it thicker, and it would liquefy when pressure was applied, and so you didn't have as much problem with flame and explosion. I knew that guy. He was a little more up to date than 1860. 1868, W.A. Austin invented a steam-driven motorcycle. 1868, you know the motorcycle 1968 was just 100 years old? I mean, you're not dealing with something, we think sometimes they've existed forever. This is why Europeans laugh at Americans. We're still infants on the block. In 1868, A.J. Fellows, Mark should know this, what did A.J. Fellows invent in 1868? Nope. You use one every day. Nope. You're too technical. He invented a tape measure. A tape measure, 1868. 1868, Christopher Sholes invented a commercial typewriter. You realize until then, people had to handwrite and then set type for what they wanted to do. 1868. 1869, George Westinghouse invented an air brake. 1869, W.F. Semple invented chewing gum. Why did he invent it? Probably to entertain his kids and keep their mouths shut, and then he invented making a fortune off of it. 1869, Thomas Edison invented a voting machine. 1869, Ives McGaffey invented an auto suction vacuum cleaner. Aren't you glad he was there? We go through all this. We won't bother with it. We could go on and on. 1872, the first mail order catalog was issued by Montgomery Ward. 1872. Let's give you some here that are 100 years old. We're in the 90s. Let's see here. In 1892, Joshua Pusey invented book matches. They're 100 years old. In 1892, W. Painter invented a bottle cap. In 1893, William Burroughs invented the adding machine. And I guarantee it wasn't a computer. In 1895, a guy by the name of K.C. Gillette invented the first safety razor. They were using straight razors 100 years ago. In 1896, Samuel P. Langley invented a flying model airplane. In 1897, C.W. Post invented the first breakfast cereal, less than 100 years ago. In 1898, Michael Owens invented a bottle-making machine. In 1899, A.T. Marshall invented the first household refrigerator. 1901, Peter C. Hewitt invented a mercury vapor lamp. In 1903, the Wright brothers took their first successful flight, and on and on and on you go. Now, who were these people? Every name I mentioned made $1 million or made wealth off of what they invented. Every one of them. And we hear a lot of talk. I am not a materialist. I don't believe you need to grab for all the gusto you can get, but I also don't believe you penalize productivity. And these people, every one of them, were wealthy people. And there is a gulf today widening between the impoverished and the wealthy, because the impoverished are made to feel it's the wealthy people's fault that you don't get a chance. I'll tell you something else about these people. 80% of them, before they invented what they invented, were impoverished. And their vehicle to wealth was their invention. You don't hear a lot told about that. You've got Edison in there. Edison invented all kinds of things back through the late 1800s. Edison was a matter of fact, they didn't want him in school. They said that he could never learn. He was an imbecile. He was too dumb to educate. And Edison, you look at all the things that your life is touched by, the things that Edison invented. I'll tell you what Edison was. Edison was poor, and he wanted some money, and he was willing to do whatever it took. If you go up to Greenfield Village, you'll find the Menlo Park laboratory where he worked so long. And up on the second floor was his office. And they'll tell you, as you go there, if there's a guide, they'll tell you that he began to devise the incandescent light bulb right there in that very room. And he brought metals from all over the world to use as the filament for that. And they would build the thing, they would put the glass around it, they would put it to the test, and every time it would fail. And when it would fail, Edison would throw it out the window and start all over again. And by the time Edison invented a tungsten filament for an incandescent light bulb, he had a pile of failures outside his window that reached the second floor window. You know what it takes to get by today? It takes the same thing it took then. It takes persistence and desire and drive. That's all it takes. The sad part about it is those things have been largely abolished, because you know as soon as you invent it, somebody's going to control it. And so the day and age of inventors is all but gone. People are not designing them anymore. Now then, what all took place? We talk about railroad development. We talked about from 1850 to 1900, railroad going from 20,000 miles of laid rail to almost 200,000 miles of laid rail, and the benefits that came from that. Agricultural improvement. A lot of the inventions of the late 1800s were in the area of agriculture, the ability to get your crops into the ground quicker and to grow them more efficiently and to bring them out of the field quicker and to get them to market. All of those things designed more capital and produced more capital, but in the process they made the vocation of farming much easier, and it gave us the fact that here we are in America today, we have fewer farmers than probably any other industrialized country in the world. America has fewer farmers. And there are fewer and fewer every year. And yet America feeds, I think the last time I saw the margin was 10 times more people than any other farmer on the face of the earth. American farmers have the ability to do that. Why? Somebody wanted to make some money. John Deere and that pretty green tractor, listen, he wasn't a humanitarian. He wanted to help out his fellow man. He wanted some green stuff in his pocket. But in the process of doing it, in the process, his greed produced a better world. And all laissez-faire capitalism is channeled greed. That's all it is. We talked about the westward expansion. We just finished the Civil War. We talked about the 15th and 16th Amendments to the Constitution, granting freedom and voting rights to slaves. And we mentioned the fact, although it's never taught very much, that the American Indian was not included in that. The American Indian did not gain his citizenship till 1924. The American Indian was counted as nothing till 1924. And the West was being settled. People were rushing out that way. 1848 had been the California Gold Rush, and the 48 and the 49ers had gone out there. The 49ers is not a football team. The 49ers were people went out there looking for gold. And about 10 years after that, 1858, the gold was discovered in Colorado near Pike's Peak. And so Colorado or bust, you know, Pike's Peak or bust became the slogan of the day. People went out to pan for gold out in Colorado. Why did they go out there? Money. You know, prosperity channels everything. And I'll be honest with you, that's the reason most of us got saved. We didn't want to go to hell. Amen? Now, we're concerned about ourselves. Humanitarians that we are, we're concerned about ourselves so much so I don't want to go to hell. I mean, you give me an option between a place that burns with fire forever and a place where the streets made of gold, I'll tell you where I'm going to go. You say, well, you're greedy. Yep, but I'm going to live in it forever in heaven. And I won't be greedy then. You know what the cure to greed is? Having it all. And someday I will have it all in heaven. The westward expansion, propelled by gold and the thoughts of free land. The government was giving away land, and people, whatever, for whatever reason, went out there to make their fortune and establish the West. We talked to you the growth. The population of the West in 1860 was 327,401 people. You say, is that an accurate figure? It must be. Why in the world would you put 401? 327,401 people was the census, 1860, in the West. By 1910, there were 9,476,769 people. In the process of 50 years, over 9 million people had migrated to the West. Why? Looking for prosperity. The people were flocking to this country in record numbers. Immigration laws were lax so that people could come to this country not to get a handout, but to get a helping hand to produce. And they came. A lot of these names I mentioned were immigrants or the sons or children of immigrants. And they had come to this country looking for an opportunity, and they gained that opportunity and made millions with it. But some other things took place in that period of time and that began to really sow some seeds that would eventually bring us back to reality. Some of the things that continued to produce prosperity were the preachers of those days. America was still a moral nation. America was still a God-fearing nation. You know, if you say that today, you can get in real trouble in some places, saying America is a God-fearing nation. And you really... It's amazing the point to which it has gone. As a chaplain for the Toledo Police Department, we have to go to school every year or so, and the teaching now is you don't pray in Jesus' name anymore. That's the teaching. You don't call Jesus' name anymore while you're praying because you might offend somebody. Now, that's the extent that it has gone to in this country, and it's a mess. You know, I mean, you can say our Creator, if you want to, or you can say the benevolent spirit, sure. Yeah, it has to be generic, which is funny. You know, if you want me to ask my dad to loan you $20, what do you care what I call him? Yeah. Amen. And if you want me to ask my God to bless what's going on here, what do you care what I call my God? You see, that's proof positive that most religion has become a facade. You know, what is done is just for the people out here. That's why you got to go to school to learn how to do that. I mean, you can't be that ignorant on purpose. You have to be taught. You really do. You have to be taught to be that ignorant. You know, how dare I offend you by calling my father dad? I wouldn't want to offend you because maybe you didn't have a dad. You know, and maybe that's being sexist, so I should call him Herm. You know. I mean, there's a point to where you take your rights so far they become wrongs, and that's where we live. Anyway, it's a mess. But you had preachers back then. You had hellfire and damnation preachers everywhere, and not just Baptists. I mean, you had some people that down south they say that guy can shell the corn, and that's a great compliment down south when they tell you can really shell the corn. And we had some preachers that could do that in this nation. And their ministries, they weren't into building big, fancy, high-rise buildings with conference centers, you know, and health spas for all the groups in there and all that kind of. They built little wood buildings and just got up and preached the fire out of people. And you've got preachers coming along through there. I listed some of them and some of the things that they accomplished. Of course, Moody would be one of the most famous. Moody Bible Institute organized on the reputation of Dwight Lyman Moody. And Moody, it was a member of the First Church, you know, the fancy church there in Chicago where everybody had their assigned pew and had the little gold plate on the pew to tell them which family owned that pew and where you could sit. And Moody noticed that a lot of those pews weren't being used. And so Moody went to the preacher and said, you know, would it be all right if I got some people to come in and sit in these pews, you know, since there's nobody sitting in them? The preacher said, well, sounds good to me. He just wanted a crowd. So Moody showed up next morning with about, 40 or 50 little runny-nosed, ragged and torn-clothes kids. And the preacher said, you can't bring them in here. So Moody said, well, I'll go start something for them. And started. That's where your Sunday school movement came from, was Dwight Lyman Moody. You kind of get the impression that American churches have been having Sunday schools for years. No, it's about 100 years old, the Sunday schools. Moody invented that. You've got R.A. Torrey, and R.A. Torrey took Moody's work and ran Moody's Bible Institute, where they were training those young men to serve the Lord. It's Moody Bible Institute in Chicago today. R.A. Torrey was the fellow that took that. T. DeWitt Talmage. T. DeWitt Talmage was a Presbyterian. And if you think I'm hard preaching, you ought to read some of T. DeWitt Talmage's sermons. I think, saw a thing that they talking about the reactionary views of the Baptists in America. Well, you know what? The Baptists are still preaching the same thing today that the Presbyterians and the Methodists were preaching 50 years ago, but they lost their guts. Yeah. T. DeWitt Talmage could preach circles around me. And T. DeWitt Talmage was a Presbyterian, a Brooklyn Presbyterian. Can you imagine somebody going to a Presbyterian church in Brooklyn today and hearing anything worth taking home with it? T. DeWitt Talmage's sermons were published in over 2,500 newspapers every week. 2,500 newspapers. That was in a day when we didn't have, we've got more newspapers by far and away now than we had back then. There weren't that many newspapers back then. 2,500 newspapers published his entire sermon every week. You had some fellows that would preach. You had J. Wilbur Chapman. In 1895, Dwight Lyman Moody called J. Wilbur Chapman the greatest evangelist our nation's seen. These fellows were preaching literally to crowds in the thousands and sometimes the tens of thousands. You've got Charles Haddon Spurgeon. I've got some lithograph prints of Spurgeon's meetings. And Spurgeon, when he was 22 years of age, was preaching to 30,000 people at one time. You know, people kind of get in awe of a guy like Billy Graham because he can fill up a stadium. Let me tell you how you do that. You send letters to every church in town and you get every church to commit to bring so many hundred people. And so when you have a big crusade and you see it on TV, it looks like that place is just packed out. But I'll tell you what, there aren't that many sinners in that place. Now, I'm not trying to undo what he's done. I know some people have been saved. But what you've got is an attempt to duplicate what was done naturally through the power of the Holy Spirit back in the turn of the century. Spurgeon got up one Sunday morning in his Metropolitan Tabernacle and told, I think, 8,000 or 9,000 people, I can't remember how many it would see, told them not to come back that night so the people outside could get in, have a chance to hear him preach. And that night they packed it out again with the people from outside. What was that, preacher? There was a hunger in the hearts of these people. Their lives were being blessed and things were happening in their lives. Their country was growing, expanding. Their livelihoods were improving. And they sought God to be thankful. And God rose up, raised up some preachers and they just preached the fire out of them. And they got right. You had some fellows like Sam Jones, a great Nazarene preacher. Sam Jones, listen, he could paint off a barn wall. And you talk about some rough, rough preaching. These were guys that they got out and walked right down. They'd get in the pews. And you know, he'd be the banker would be sitting here on the front row. They'd get right in his face and preach to him. Preach to him about money and the love of money. I mean, they'd get right in your face. I remember some of that as I was growing up. I remember Harvey Springer walking the backs of the pews in the Dayton Baptist Temple. While he's preaching, he's walking down the pews from back to back. And people just kind of scooted over. You say, oh, he was a ruffian. I know, that's why that church was running about 5,000 then. And that's why every night when he gave invitation, it would be about 50 to 100 grown men and women come down weeping and crying and get right with God. That's why when he left, bars were closed forever and houses of prostitution shut down for good. That's why, you know, he was kind of a little unconventional and unorthodox. You've got fellas, Billy Sunday preached out here at Swain Field when it wasn't a slum. And Billy Sunday, when he left this town, go back and read the newspaper accounts of when Billy Sunday was in this town. And look at how many bars closed down and how many tavern owners got rid of their business and burned their whiskey. And look at how many places like that shut down. They had an effect in this nation. And they had an effect in this nation that kept it good. During those days, the Pacific Garden Mission was started, one of the first rescue missions in America. During those days of the late 1800s, early 1900s, the Salvation Army was started first in England by William Booth, 1878. By 1880, it was in this nation. It is still today one of the top three disaster relief agencies in the world. Why? Now, I'll give you some interesting thought about this. Booth never made $1 million. George Mueller had his home over there in England taking care of orphans. He never made $1 million. When he died, he didn't leave much behind him at all. Here were some men that cared. And some of these preachers cared, and some of these preachers were preaching. You've got this televangelist crowd today, and you've got to make the big bucks. You've got to have the money to buy your Mercedes and whatever. And some of these preachers were just preaching because they want to see souls saved. And God blessed them. Religion played a key part in the lives of people of this age. Let me give you two other things real quick. One other thing was education. In 1890, now I'll give you an idea, just think for a minute what religion and education have in common today. Okay, how they get along so well. In 1890, that was 100 years ago, 11 out of every 12 high school graduates graduated from private schools. And most of those private schools were religious schools. So less than 100 years ago, the church was educating 11 times more people than the public sector was doing. Without any government funding, without any help, without any laws and regulations, they were turning them out. And today, you try to get a Bible club started in a public school. See what happens. In 1850, 28% of American people were illiterate. Just 40 years before. And that process began under private education, and then I'm not opposed to public education. It worked real good until about 1830 or 1930. And then I can tell you where it went wrong. It took a wrong turn, 1930. But up till about 1930, they began to reduce literacy. The illiteracy rate in America today in 1980 is 1%. But we're about 11th on the list. About 11th on the list of productive people. You know who number one is? People we're in a trade war with, trying to keep them from selling their products over here. The Japanese. The Japanese is 11 times better than America when it comes to education. One other thing. A trend began to develop, and we got to close here somewhere, but a trend began to develop, and if I had time, we could develop these thoughts. What education happened, what happened in 1930 to education, what happened in economics as the government secured more and more control of industry and sought to control it. But something else happened, and people began to move to the cities. The cities became the places where everything was. And as you had money and prosperity, you wanted to buy those things, you wanted to have those things. You had to go to the city to obtain them. And as they did, people began to stay in the city, began to make their homes in the cities. In 1860, which is the year the Civil War was to begin, one out of every four Americans lived in a city. Three out of every four Americans lived out on farms. By 1980, three out of every four Americans live in the city, and one out of every four live on the farm. And the problems that are inherent with that have produced the America that you and I know. It's kind of funny today, people are in factories living in town working so they can make enough money to go buy the farmland. And they left the farmland to come to the city. And it's an interesting, I can't remember, there's a book I read years ago, kind of a satire about all of it, but I talked to a man, his name was Fitzhugh, his last name's Fitzhugh. And Mr. Fitzhugh lives about probably 20 miles north of Panama City, Florida, where all the condominiums and everything are going in. And Mr. Fitzhugh just owns a hunk of land, that's what he calls it. You ask him how much he's got, he'll tell you it's a hunk. My dad used to go back in there, cypress swamps, and I mean, you talk about back in the Everglades, that's what it looks like. We'd go back in there, a little bass boat, and fish. He'd got a lot of lakes back in there, little ponds. We'd go back in there and fish. And there's only one road in, and it's right next to his house. You go back on his property and fish, you have to drive past his house. And he wouldn't let just anybody in. He let in who he wanted to let in. And so we'd always stop and talk to Mr. Fitzhugh when we come out. He was an elderly man, and as far as I know, he's probably up in his 90s now, late 90s, if that, and still alive. And we'd stop and sit out on the porch and talk to Mr. Fitzhugh. And I was a kid. I asked him one time, I said, Mr. Fitzhugh, I said, how much land have you got? And he said, scratched his chin. And he said, son, I don't rightly know. He said, we fenced it last year on three sides, and he said it was 35 miles of fence I had to buy. He didn't know how many acres that is. He said, I had 35 miles of fence to fence three sides of it. And I said, well, why don't you sell some? You could make millions of dollars. And he just got real stern and he looked at me. He said, son, people's got money want to buy land. You say, what is that? That's an uneducated, illiterate millionaire that doesn't have any money. He's got what he wants. And this nation became a nation where people became impressed. Let's get into the city. You can make more money, you know. I mean, how many people from Kentucky and Tennessee live in Michigan and Ohio? Left the farm to come work in a factory to make $1 million. And if you were to meet them today on the assembly line and say, what are you looking forward to? Say, someday I'm going to retire and move back to the farm. You could have stayed on the farm and saved yourself a whole lot of headaches. But that'll give you an idea of what American ideals went to. Someday we'll finish this, Lord willing.